Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Let's inherit the earth, 'cause no one else is taking it. Come on, do your worst before the moment's past. In bedrooms across England and all the Western world, there's posters and there's magazines, but music isn't ours. 'Cause we write love songs and sing, and we do politics in G. We sing songs about our friends in E minor. So tear down the stars now and take up your guitars, and come on, folks, and try this at home. Let's stop waiting around.
Why, what secrets have you got, Dave?
So many secrets. So many secrets. We call him Secrets Dave. Or at least we do now.
We do now, yeah. It's on record. So, Frank, we've got a bit of Beatles mania happening out the front of Waterstones in Birmingham. Birmingham City Centre has not seen a crowd like this since...
That was Liverpool.
No, we're in Birmingham.
Where I was this morning.
This Beatles mania is wherever you go.
Oh, I see.
At the moment,
okay.
It seems.
They're extremely misguided people. They've got the wrong band.
You're in the thrall of a UK book tour,
yes,
signings, live Q&As, live performances.
Yes.
You've got two coffees.
I do. Two coffees, Turner.
You've got like a long one and a chaser.
Yeah, right, exactly. And actually today, it's lovely to see you, man.
Lovely to see you, dude. I've just kind of gone in guns a-blazing like
good.
A bull in a china shop.
We're pros. We're good at this. An auspicious morning because today is publication day.
Is it really?
Which is funny because, like, I mean, obviously we've been selling and the books for the last few days anyway.
Yeah.
And, like, you know, they've been shipped out by Amazon and all that sort of crap, but like officially as of 2 hours ago the book is available.
Fuck yeah, dude. Well, congratulations.
Thank you very much.
Cheers.
Yes.
Let's toast.
Cheers. Let's chink
with China
hot drinks for that. Yeah. But it's exciting, you know. I now have two books. I'm now an author for real. Definitely. It wasn't
legit.
Wasn't an error the first time around.
I've got to say, with this book, I just finished reading it last night, so it's very much fresh in my mind.
Excellent.
And we're just going to talk solely about the book today.
Great.
If that's cool with you.
Very much so.
Much like your music, it's incredibly open and honest, and I love the way that your own music isn't above reappraisal and criticism from yourself, and you're very just upfront with the way you feel about songs.
Yeah, well, that struck me as a really important thing to do because, first of all, the genesis of the book was that I wrote the book about touring, and it's a book that covers about 1,200 shows, and it occurred to me that in writing about 1,200 shows, which is quite a lot of shows, I hadn't ever really talked about the songs I was playing whilst doing that, which put me in mind of the fact that at the Independent Music Awards in 2012, I won an award for being hardest working artist, and then I won an award for being best live act, and I was quite pleased that I got the second one because it's possible to be the hardest working artist and still be shit.
Yeah, yeah, of course.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah,
it's
like
there's no.
You got to love a tryer, but you still suck.
Yeah, it's like that's an award for quantity rather than quality. So it was nice to get a quality one as well. So similarly, it struck me that there was a gap there and that could be filled if I felt like it. So it's a book about songwriting, but sort of about a third of the way through the process, I realised that I was in danger of writing a book about how brilliant I was. And that would be trying for a reader, I suspect. And I just think it's more interesting to talk about it's not a manual about songwriting, but it has a sort of didactic angle. You know, it's supposed to hopefully, if you are interested in songwriting, learn something, and you learn as much from your failures as you do from your successes, I think.
Well, you also kind of very openly wear your influences on your sleeve.
Mm.
And you'll say, I got that idea directly from this person, directly from this song. And I'm not a songwriter, but I could imagine anybody who does write music for a living or for a passion would very much feel like the fuel is lit inside them after reading this book, because it does, as you say, it's not a tutorial, but it definitely does break down, I guess, some of the methodology.
Yeah, right, exactly, yes. But I'm interested in your take on it as someone who doesn't write songs, because I was also, whilst writing it, was keeping in mind that I wanted it to be a book that would be of interest to people who aren't songwriters. Do you know what I mean? And I didn't want it to be just a thing where if you're like, well, I don't play guitar and write songs, therefore this book isn't for me. I don't want that to be the case.
Of course. So my honest and upfront opinion is that I loved it as basically an autobiography.
Yeah, it's kind of it has a strong element of autobiography to it, because I write in a confessional style.
Of course,
I always have.
Yes,
done.
Yeah. If your music was different, it would have been a very different book.
You know, I mean, I'm not. This, I get crucified for saying this. I'm not a huge fan of Tom Waits' music, but I am fascinated by him. And part of the reason I'm fascinated by him is because his approach is so radically different from mine. Because his music is, in the strictest sense of the word, performance art. He plays a character. I think Tom Waits is a character.
Of course, yeah. He's become one of the characters in his songs, hasn't he?
But I mean, in from what I know about him, his personal life is extremely private.
Uh-huh.
And he doesn't do much in the way of interviews. And he, you know, never really talks about his life. And I think he's happily married and has this life that is completely out of the public glare. And I think that's a really interesting take. Obviously, it's radically different from my approach to it, in the sense that, like, to a degree, my songwriting has been a public form of therapy over the last decade.
And I think that's what people love about your music, and that's their connection to it.
Right. And I mean, for me, that's what I like in the music that I listen to. And so, and therefore, in terms of being influenced, that's what I want to do. You know, I mean, one of my first loves, which I talk about in the book, is Counting Crows. And what I love about August and Everything After is the sound of a man deconstructing himself very publicly. And I've always loved that. Or Arab Strap, who are another huge influence for me. Like, I find Aidan Moffat's lyrics actively difficult to listen to because he's so excoriating about himself. Arab Strap is the
close
sound...
Close to the bone.
Yeah, it's the sound of a man baring his chest and stabbing it with a scalpel in front of you.
Yeah.
And you know, Pax of Three, just at the end of that song, where the lyric is, you said I'm an arsehole, what was I thinking? It's far too easy to blame it on the drinking. And it's just that is wow,
poetry, like, isn't it?
It is poetry, but it makes my
it's
hand,
direct.
My hair is standing off my arms inside my jacket as I recite that line. So you know, that's my approach to it. But I respect Tom Waits, and I'm interested in that very different approach to art, because of course not all art has to be confessional. It just happens to be the art that I make.
Well, you mentioned in the book, and we should probably shout out Jay here, as you do in the book.
Yes,
After Million Dead Finish, and you're trying to figure out where to go next and trying to find your voice, you say in the book that there was a moment where you had almost, I guess, like an epiphany, a revelation, which was, I guess, kind of thanks to Jay. And it was this
very
idea
much so.
Of we can be the heroes of our own stories.
Exactly, yeah. I mean, Jay, I was in the middle. With Million Dead, I wrote deliberately obtuse lyrics. And there was, whilst I'm extremely proud of everything we did in Million Dead, there was definitely, listening back to it now, I hear the sound of a young man trying to prove that he's read a lot of books, which is not necessarily the purest artistic inspiration, you know what I mean? And they were deliberately complicated, and I was trying to sound clever and all this kind of shit. And then I heard,
the music was too.
Yeah. And then I heard Jay singing a song with three chords about last weekend, and thought, fuck me, it's simultaneously very folk and very punk in its way. And it, as I discuss in the book, the expression folk punk is a slightly troubling one for me, in the sense that it's facile and reductionist. But nevertheless, like, that was a huge thing for me. Interestingly, I sent a copy of the book to Jay, because he's one of the three people I dedicated it to, and I thought that was the appropriate thing to do. And Jay was very sweet about it, and he wrote back, and he sort of said, I had no idea.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and he sort of said, not least, the song specifically that I mentioned is Steve and the Secret Chinese Army,
which
was about our mate Steve took acid and thought that he was being hunted by Chinese soldiers.
We've all been there.
Yeah, and Jay wrote a song about it the following week. And Jay sort of said, I thought that was a throwaway song. I haven't even thought about that song for 15 years. And I was like, well, you know, careful what you write, I suppose. You know,
I guess
I mean?
It's that thing that one man's sort of throwaway is another man's know, lightning bolt, isn't it?
Well, I mean, that brings up an interesting thing for me, actually. And obviously, everyone has different perceptions of different songs and different art and all the rest of it. In choosing to write bits of the book about what I consider to be my less successful moments as a songwriter, my reticence about doing that was just simply because in the past, whenever I choose to talk about a song of mine that I don't think is as good, it always turns out that the person I'm talking to has the lyrics tattooed on their chest and is then heartbroken because I've just told them I don't like the song that is their passion.
It's changed
much.
My life, man.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, yeah. Funnily enough, the very first tattoo of any lyrics of mine I ever saw On the first Million Dead record, which I'm very proud of, there is only one lyric on the record that I would change if I could, and that was
on the whole
lyric,
album.
On the whole album, that was the lyric the guy had tattooed on his leg, and I was just like, "Oh wow!" I mean, in a way, it sort of makes me reevaluate it and think maybe it is a good lyric after all. But it was just kind of like, I can't fucking believe it.
Well, art's so subjective as well, isn't it? And that's kind of case in point there.
Yes, and I think I also, again, as I say in the book at length, I think that something I was wary of is like, I don't necessarily want this book to change people's opinions of the songs or at least their connections to the songs. I think that interpretation is paramount. Do you know what I mean? And at the risk of invalidating the entire project, I don't want to stand there and be like, no, this song means this, because a song means whatever you think it means.
Yeah.
And there is no wrong interpretation of a song. There's no wrong interpretation of art. That's a ridiculous concept to me. Interpretation is key. Interpretation is almost the funnest part, actually. To put something out into the world and then see somebody take a different take on it is fascinating to me. There is a guy in Germany who has a theory that all my songs are part of a grand scheme.
Yeah.
And he's wrong, but I told him he was right because I want to know where he's going with it. And I kind of wait for updates from him on like, you know, how all of the characters are interrelated. I mean, they are to the extent that it's mostly about my life.
Yeah,
but like,
yeah, yeah.
You know, he's just kind of like, well, this person is actually the person mentioned in that song. And it's just like, really? Okay. I imagine he's got a cork board with like bits of string and drawing pins on it. And I'd love to see it.
There's a moment in the book where you talk about one song. I think perhaps it's the I Knew Proof Rock before he got famous.
Yeah.
You were saying you were kind of at the end of a massive touring schedule. You were knackered. You were having one of those nights where you're like, oh man, I need to fucking pull the energy out of the bag somehow. And you said you looked out in the crowd and there's a guy, is it this song?
Yes.
There's a guy with his eyes closed, singing along to every word. And again, you sort of say, well, I have one of those moments where I realise that the song's so deeply personal to me.
Yeah.
Somehow is so transcendental and universal.
Yeah, which is a wonderful, wonderful thing, and it's a humbling thing, and it's a thing that you can't really aim for as a writer. You just have to sort of hope it works out that way. I think the metaphor I use in the book is it's like a magic eye picture. You can't look directly at it. You know, you have to just sort of slip into it. But, I mean, it's a funny thing. Something that I take great joy from is the fact that, like, it never occurred to me to use fake names in Proof Rock. That all the people mentioned in that song are real people. And, you know, many times over the years I've introduced someone to Dave Danger or Tree or whatever, and they kind of do a double take and go, wait, what?
The person from the song.
Yeah, totally. And they kind of go, oh, okay, fuck, it's a real thing. Which I quite like. The other one with that, which so Dan's song, which I don't talk about at length in the book, but when Proof Rock came out, it was essentially a list of the people who lived and worked at a bar called Nambuka in North London in about 2004.
I'd love to go back to that in a moment.
Okay,
as well.
Yeah, sure. 2005 maybe, but I forgot Dan. And it's an easy syllable to get into a song. Do you know what I mean? It's not a challenge to get the word Dan, and it rhymes with quite a lot of stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
And all this kind of thing. And when the song came out, I think he was genuinely a bit hurt and was like, oh,
I'm not on the radar.
Why?
I don't matter.
And I was so mortified because it wasn't a deliberate slight in any way.
Yeah, yeah.
So I then wrote Dan's song in order to set that right. But then since then, I have met so many people who have not. It's never quite the individual themselves. It's always like, oh yeah, you wrote a song about my mate Dan Johnson, and I'm like, no, I fucking didn't. Who the fuck is that? So I think there's quite a few people who have claimed to be Dan. Danny Varley, as his name actually is, was for a time known as the real Dan.
There you go.
I think he's moved beyond that in terms of his nomenclature these days, but he's a lovely man.
That scene at that time, tell me about it, because it seems like a lot of people who were around then went on to do great things. And for me, there's this kind of magic to certain places and times, you know, be that CBGBs in the 70s or, you know, it seems like there's always one club or a venue or a space, place. And then somehow this loose collective of people all at the same point come up together and almost for the large part all go on to do at least something of
that. I've been lucky in my life to actually have that happen to me arguably twice. The first time, the UKHC scene that I was part of when I was a teenager and was definitely just a bit, you know, a minor bit player in. I was in a band called Knee Jerk and I put on like three shows or something. But I do often run into people from that scene who are doing things in the music industry. For example, Sheep, who used to put on hardcore shows in Leeds, now tour managers Bring Me the Horizon. Do you know what I mean? And like Matt Cabani, who used to just video shows, now promotes me in Italy. Like, and it's kind of cool that we were all like teenagers, had no idea what we were doing. And many of us, it's because of the philosophy of DIY that you know, that idea of just like, just fucking do it, don't wait. And that's been really helpful for a lot of us. The Nambuka thing, you know, I sort of stumbled into this scene. It was a running joke when I first showed up, because I came down socially, and they were very heavily involved in the kind of mid-2000s guitar thing, the Libertines, Kaiser Chiefs, all that kind of business. And I didn't like any of that music, and nobody in that scene liked Million Dead. And it was a bit of a joke that I was the musical outsider.
Did you end up there then?
Because I was friends with Dave.
Right.
In fact, Dave, I won't go into the details, but Dave did me an enormous solid in my personal life at a time when I didn't know him very well. And I thought, wow, you're a thoroughly decent person.
I want to be
person.
Close to this guy and in
yeah.
this scene.
Cause and I just started hanging legit. Out at the bar because I'd sort of become alienated from the other bar I used to hang out at. But and then made friends with everybody. But it was funny. And I mean, there was actually an incident where Million Deads played at Reading 2005. They used to run the club nights at Reading. We always used to go down on the Thursday night. And everybody came to see Million Dead for the first time because we were there anyway. And they all walked in and there were shitloads of people there. And everyone was like, holy shit, people like your band. And I'm like, they do. Like, your world is not the entire world, you fuckers. but anyway, so the thing is that my wariness about talking about it is that I don't want it to sound cliquey and exclusionary. Because, and it quite easily can sound that way. And I understand that. And the thing was that there were no barriers to entry. Literally, Danny was part of that scene because he just showed up. One day, Danny was just there, and everyone went, okay, you're nice, and that carried on. I mean, I think the only barrier to entry was kind of like enthusiasm. Do you know what I mean? You had to be the kind of person who would show up and get stuck in. But it wasn't like, you know, a club or anything like that. And there were plenty of people who wandered through and came and went and all the rest of it. But it was really exciting. It was a moment in time where we were young enough to not know the rules, which I think is what makes those scenes exciting. Do you know
Absolutely,
what I mean?
Absolutely, yeah. There's an innocence and a purity.
Yeah, it was just kind of, and it was like every week someone had a new band, a new record, a new photo project, a new zine, a new whatever, and you know, a new club night somewhere. Someone would start DJing at a club we never heard of, and we'd all go, okay, and we'd all go down. And it was so exciting. And, you know, the list of alumni from there is pretty good. You know, I mean, Florence lived upstairs for a while. Jamie T was around a lot. Obviously, the Holloways came out there. There was me. Marcus Mumford was around from time to time. You know, Noah and the Whale guys. Laura Marling was a huge part of it.
One of the Vaccines guys. We
yeah,
saw
yeah.
Well,
yeah. Jay, who Justin, who went on, JJ Pistolet was his name. Justin, who went on to form the Vaccines and has done very well at that. And some people, I think, I'm not sure that Florence talks about Nambuka ever. I'm not sure whether it's a huge part of her personal history. But for me, it really was such a pivotal time in my life.
It was like university for
yeah,
your songwriting.
Basically, yeah. And it's funny that you mentioned that, actually, because like I went to LSE and I can barely remember it. Yeah, I was there for 3 years, but I was on tour for the whole fucking thing. And like, it's funny. I remember my parents kind of saying to me, well, university is where you make your friends for life. I'm not in touch with a single person.
I'm in touch with two. Like,
right,
literally, yeah.
I do every now and again, I'll bump into somebody, but it just doesn't figure very highly in my life. Whereas Nambuka is a hugely important thing for me. But yeah, and I mean, I specifically learned about folk music. One of the funny parts of that story is that because the gang, as it were, we used to run a club night on a Friday and a Saturday, and it was a very chemically fueled scene, and we would not sleep from Friday until Sunday. And on Sunday we started running a folk night called Sensible Sundays, not because anyone was interested in folk music, but because we couldn't handle drums anymore. And so it was just like,
come down
at that point in our sort of chemical arc. It was just kind of it has to be acoustic and slow and gentle, please. And then people like Jamie T started showing up, and we were all like, oh, fucking hell. I remember Jamie showing up with an acoustic bass and, you know, and playing...
like a big double one?
But like slapping it and playing beats on the side of it and kind of rapping and playing Sheila and all the rest of it, and all of us being like, what the fuck is he doing? And then kind of going, oh, wait a second, this song's completely incredible. So, you know, it was an exciting time.
Well, you say in the book as well that the part of, at least, the inspiration and drive behind you really trying to up your game was the success of Jamie T. Is that safe to say?
Yes, very much so.
And you're I've got to fucking up my game.
Yeah, I haven't seen Jamie in more than a decade, and it would be a stretch to say that we were like close friends or anything, but we hung out a bit and played a bunch of shows together. But yeah, I think, as I mentioned in the book, I mean, there were two differences between his debut album and mine, one of which was that his was better. But importantly as well, it's important to recognise he was on a massive major label and I was on a tiny indie. But it definitely, I remember kind of the quality rather than financial side of it. I was listening to his record going, motherfucker, I need to do better. And it really...
Healthy competition,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, absolutely. And I do believe that, like, it's important. I think it's funny, we were discussing this at the book show last night. There are two ways, I think, that different people react to artistic competition, and one of them is to feel challenged and the other is to feel inspired. And I definitely fall into the latter category. That's why I like taking out bands on tour as support that I think are better than me.
Because
I want to watch them and go, oh, fuck, right, okay, time to up our game. Do you know what I mean? And similarly, yeah, you know, my reaction to hearing a great song is to go, right, how do I write a song that's that good? Do you know what I mean?
Absolutely.
Fucking, you know, what are they doing that's better than what I do? So it's, and I think that's a healthy mental attitude.
Definitely. I'm going to have a quick tea, quick top
do
up
it,
here.
Do it. I'm on my second coffee for the listeners at home. I'm going to start traveling through time and space reasonably soon. I have been up since 7 a.m.
Yeah, Ian text me. So I'm going to put out a podcast with Ian Winwood next week. And Frank is currently on tour with Ian. And Ian's conducting the Q&As. And he's also just brought out a book recently, which you hosted a Q&A.
I did. I got him back
as well. And it's a great book, isn't it? It's like, it finally, that period in time.
That's the word,
has
finally
been covered in the Jew.
My God, there are too many fucking books about 77 Punk.
I mean, and grunge and the Seattle scene.
Yeah, but the thing is that nobody needs to write any more books about 77 Punk anyway, because England's Dream by John Savage exists and has existed for years, and that's the only book that needs to exist about it. And everybody bangs on and on and on about that period of time. And yes, it was exciting and interesting, but your and my experience of punk rock was Green Day and Offspring.
Yep.
It just fucking was. And no one has written a book about it before. And in a funny way, in a way that I'm quite, that makes me quite fond and defensive of it, it's still kind of like the ugly stepchild of not only music generally, but punk rock as well. It's not considered particularly cool to be influenced by that stuff. But fuck it, I don't give a shit. NoFX is one of my biggest influences.
Fuck, well, we spoke about this many times.
Yeah.
My favourite band, like the band that inspired me
like,
to go down.
And I don't
all
give a
hole.
Shit about whether or not that's credible in any way. Fuck off. Do you know what I mean? Like, it was great music. Descendants, Everything Sucks is still my favourite punk record of all time. And, you know, also, it's a funny thing, like, once or twice in my life, somebody somewhere has said something slightly dismissive about me being just like, oh man, you're just a gateway band at best kind of thing. To which I'm kind of like, thank you very much. Because the fact of the matter is, there is nobody on this earth since the early 80s who has woken up and bought a Black Flag record apropos of nothing. It doesn't happen like that. People woke up and they bought a Green Day record, and then they bought a NoFX record, and then they bought a Descendants record, and then they bought a Black Flag record. Because you can't get to underground obscure music without a conduit to get there.
Of course,
and
need the building blocks, don't
you? If all I ever do with my life is encourage more people to listen to the Weaker Thans, that's fucking fine, because they're my favourite band. So, wicked. Listen to the Weaker Thans.
And in the book as well, you talk about how you don't shun the term entertainer. Mm. Whereas some people, you know, they'll often, as an artist, you know, I'm an artist.
Or and particularly if they put the letter E on the end of it. Artiste. Fuck off.
You fully embrace the fact that you are a performer and an entertainer, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's a separate discipline, being a performer to being a songwriter. It's something I wish I'd learned a long time ago, is that musicianship, songwriting and performance are three entirely separate disciplines. Obviously, what I and people in my line of work are trying to do is be good at all three at the same time, which is hard to do.
That's the holy grail, right?
It is, and it's the reason why Springsteen is so revered, is that he's extremely fucking good at all three. But it's entirely possible to be good at two and not at one. Kurt Cobain, incredible songwriter, incredible performer, kind of terrible musician, to be honest. Eddie Van Halen, right? Incredible performer, incredible musician, not that keen in his songs.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? So it's and hopefully we all try and be good at all three, and all due respect to both Kurt Cobain and Eddie Van Halen. Probably more.
I'm better than them.
More no.
Because I can do all
three. No,
I'm just joking.
Being a performer, I mean, but it's also like, I think that I have this sort of theory, and I talk about it in the book, and I've talked about it in the past, that, like, I think to be an entertainer is a noble thing, actually. And it's a sociological term more than anything else. Do you know what I mean? If you draw a sort of diagram of society, and you've got teachers over there, and you've got policemen over there, and you've got nurses in the middle, and whatever else, one little corner is entertainers. And our job is, at the end of a shitty working week with people doing real jobs and they need to have the weight lifted for a minute or two, that's what we do. And I think that's noble. And it puts, by using that term, it puts me in the same category as vaudeville and circus and music hall and the theater and everything else, you know. And I'm, that's kind of why I'm obsessed with that stuff. And I have to mention Chaz and Dave here, who
yeah, of course, man,
one of my all-time favorite
legendary
bands. Very, very sad that Chaz passed away. Not least because I did get the chance to play with them once on stage and to hang out with them. I showed them my Chaz and Dave tattoo. They were kind of like, okay. but like, we were in talks for them to do some shows with me.
Oh, that would have been
good. Would have been I was even considering booking them for my wedding. I'm not sure that my missus is as into Chaz and Dave as I am. But they did do weddings. That was the thing they did. But obviously none of that's going
to
happen now.
And you'll
that's
have to great, just get Jay sadness. Now.
Yeah. Well, but it, and on the day that he died, I was in Montreal, of all places, which is not a place where anyone's heard of Chaz and Dave. But I played a Chaz and Dave song that night and explained to the crowd, shut the fuck up and listen to this. This is, yeah, I played Ain't No Pleasing You.
And you can hear it in your music, especially around the sort of England Keep My Bones era. You can hear music hall really rising to the forefront.
Yeah.
Four Simple Words, obviously, is probably the most obvious
yes,
example.
Yes, right, exactly. And, but I mean, you know, that there's something about that kind of po-facedness of refusing to be an entertainer and sort of like, which I just think is kind of dull. Do you know what I mean? And plus, it's also, but incidentally, for the people, the bands that exist, like, I always think of Pink Floyd, which may or may not be fair. But, like, it's like you're charging people money to come into a room and see you play music. Yes, you're a fucking entertainer. Get over yourself. Do you know what I mean? Anyway, but whatever. Pink Floyd don't know who I am and don't care.
so that album for me was probably when I really got into you. I was working on Kerrang Radio at the time. I remember playing I Still Believe loads on the radio. And that for me, still one of my favourite songs that you've ever done. Because I remember hearing it for the first time and going, wow, this is like a country clash. And he's referencing Jerry Lee, Elvis Presley, Johnny Cash. And for me at that time, maybe even now as well, nobody was referencing those people.
Yeah.
Well, contemporary artists,
yeah,
anyway.
Yeah, yeah.
And I thought, what a fucking interesting song. And
you've
sort of addressed, again, I'm going to the book a lot, but you address it in the book that part of the criticism of that song was that it was too earnest.
Yeah.
And again, there's like this kind of tradition. I spoke to Billy Corgan about it a few years ago, name drop, where he says there's this tradition in kind of the music press and in hipster culture where you have to be ironic and to be sincere is almost like a negative.
Yes, completely. I mean,
and that's bullshit as well, I think.
Well, it's an approach that I don't sympathize with.
Yeah.
I think that there's a place for it, do you know what I mean? And like, I can understand that, like, there are some bands who, I mean, you know, whether you're
if you're Electric Six, for instance, then great.
Well, but even like if you think about stuff like, I don't know, kind of more stuff like Suede or Royal Trucks or stuff like that, do you know what I mean? It's like knowing and all that kind of thing, and there's a place for that, and that's good luck to all those bands. But like, for me, it's just never made sense as a criticism. It's like, that guy means what he says.
Yeah
Okay,
yeah,
I mean, what's the issue here, please? You know, and like, I've always loved the moment in music where somebody says something unretractable. Do you know what I mean? Where somebody says something and you're like, fuck me, he just said that, you know?
That's like going back to that exposing your chest and...
Yeah, right, do you know what I mean? And there's a million examples I could think of, but like, you know, Anna Begins, Counting Crows, it's a song about accidentally sleeping with your best friend kind of thing. And like, fuck me, that song is so emotionally devastating. And that's what I'm interested in. I want to be emotionally devastated by the art that I... Or not all of it, but a lot of the art that I like. But yeah, I mean, the other thing with Still Believe, and it's interesting you mentioned that thing about the name-checking thing, which is incidentally something I've arguably done a bit much in my career.
Well, you say that at a few points. There's a few sort of tactics that you have that you think you've used too much, but I think every artiste, whatever field they're working in, they have certain tropes defines their work.
Yeah, completely, which is
like
fine.
Like Tarantino, he loves a good close-up of a foot. That's his thing.
Right, exactly. but it's like, I have sort of ambitions towards kind of musicology in my personal life. Like, I'd like to know about as much music as I can and to be knowledgeable about it and have things to say. But also, like, I wish to be part of a tradition. And rock and roll is a tradition now. And actually, I think that we exist at quite an interesting moment in the history of rock and roll as an art form, because we have definitively passed the first lifetime of people who were involved in making rock and roll, and it still exists. And indeed, the same is true of punk as a concept as well. I think a part of my theory about why folk punk became a thing in the 2000s, and I was part of this, was it was a moment in time where punk rock, which was a genre that was kind of predicated on the idea of disposability and no future and all the rest of it, found itself passing to second and even third generations. And it's like, well, you have to recalibrate at some point. Do you know what I mean? You can't be like, no future 40 years on. Do you know what I mean?
Well, it's really... like The Who, isn't it? I hope I die before I get old. Yeah. They're still up there.
They're pretty fucking old now, and not, well, only one of them's dead, which is a great sadness, I should say. But yeah, so, you know, I think it's a good grounding as a musician to understand where you came from. And also, I think it's kind of, hopefully, it's kind of humbling as well. It's like I wish to take the baton from the people who came before me and pass it on to the people who come after me. You know, I think that's a good thing to do in life.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Going back to the honesty in your work, again, it's something you openly address in the book. It doesn't come without its collateral damage.
Yes.
In life.
Yeah.
And I found that a bit with my podcast is it's all well and good being honest about yourself and being open and, you know, exposed in relation to you. But obviously, as a confessional songwriter, you are going to bring in people from your life.
Yeah, because no man is an island, as they say, and all the rest of it. So, yeah, if you're writing honestly about yourself at some point, you're also going to have to write about other people because I don't live in a monk's cell. That's been a difficult moral quandary for me at times.
Rather than the relationship side of things, I wonder if you wouldn't mind, I don't want to bum you out before your big signing, the song Long Live the Queen and the problems that song obviously posed.
Well, that was it. I got hung up on that song, but I actually, that was one of the easier ones in a way, in the sense that, like, it was important to me that Lexi's family and particularly her kids were all right with the song. But I demoed the song and I sent it to them and they came back and said, this is fucking great. We're all in favour. So that was fine. And I had the same experience with Song for Josh. In fact, one thing I'm not sure I'd mention in the book is I had a slightly sticky experience with a song called Richard Devine off Poetry of the Deed, which is about a suicide. And it was about somebody I knew who committed suicide. And one of his family members was not stoked about that song, which was difficult for me. And I had sort of forgotten to check, or at least I hadn't thought to check, I should say. And that was a bit of a spanner in the works for our friendship for a time. But I mean, those kind of things, you know, you're writing about somebody else, but it's kind of third person, if you like. You know what I mean? The more difficult ones are the relationship ones, because to be in a relationship with somebody is an intimate thing, and to expose those intimacies to the harsh glare of publicity is quite a thing to do. And I think I say in the book, it's like, you know, do I have to go on dates with a fucking sign around my neck saying, warning, anything that gets said tonight may end up in a lyric? That's not a thing I can do. It's not a thing I want to do. I mean, obviously, I don't go on dates anymore because I'm getting married this year. Thank you.
Good times, man.
Yeah, and I mean, my partner and I have had some pretty in-depth conversations, not just about lyrics, actually. This is we're on a slightly sidebar here.
Go wherever you want, dude.
But, you know, Jess and I really went through quite a long thing of talking about how public we were going to be about our relationship.
Yeah, well, that's the other thing, isn't it, is now, and it freaks me out when people are so sharing with their children, like famous people have their kids with Instagram accounts and they'll be tagging them in it and they're like 5 years old. And
do you know the thing about Mick Jagger's dad comments on Instagram?
No.
It's the fucking greatest thing on the internet. Mick Jagger's son,
right,
who's like 19 and really cool,
right,
posts up his cool Instagram pictures of him being cool.
Yeah.
And then Mick Jagger, and it's his official account, is like, lol, looks great underneath in this totally dad way that's fucking incredible. And you can see the embarrassment just leaking out of your phone. Oh, God bless Mick Jagger for that. It makes me there's like whole BuzzFeed articles about this. It's amazing. You know, my initial...
So you sat down and had a long discussion.
Well, we did. Well, the thing was, my initial approach, which I've had with every other relationship I've been in prior, was to keep it very private and not post in any public way, because I need to draw a line between my public self and my private self.
Yeah.
Otherwise, I would go insane. And I did that for a while. And after a while, Jess sort of said to me, it sort of feels like I don't exist. You know, and it's like, you know, are you trying to keep yourself available in some public way or whatever? Which obviously I wasn't trying to do. But like, you know, at some point you actually have to, she was kind of like, this is our life, and I don't want to be an eminence grise necessarily. And I'm not sure that she wants people kind of, you know, showing up at a house or whatever, but like, we decided to be a little bit more public and forthright with it. And I have to say, the thing that's kind of settled it for us was my friend Jason Isbell, and the way that him and Amanda handle their online kind of presentation of their relationship is really inspiring to me, actually, because I think they do a great job of, it's kind of funny, it's playful, and it's cool, but it's also obviously very loving, and I think that's really cool, and that's the approach I'd like to go for.
Do you follow Josh Brolin?
I don't.
He is amazing with every element, not just his personal and kind of romantic and family life, but with every element of his playing with his persona and his fame. Sure. And he's so self-deprecating, and he just seems like the coolest fucking dude on earth.
Lovely.
And obviously he was in two of like the biggest films
in the world last year. Totally. I will down to earth with it.
Religion, Frank, I want to touch on that topic with you.
Here we go.
You talk about it really, again, just very forthright and open in the book, and Glory Hallelujah.
Yes.
Is a really interesting song anyway, and sort of getting a peek behind the curtain with the writing of that, the reactions and response to that. I wonder if you could tell me first of all about your mind frame going into that song.
Yeah. Well, essentially, I wrote...
And the blowback that's come from it.
I sort of wrote the chorus and thought it was kind of funny, and then just sort of kind of shelved it, didn't really think about it. I played it to Jay Beans one night on a tour bus, and he was like incensed and was like, fucking hell, man, finish that song. That's a bold statement that needs to be made. So I did. I mean, I think not necessarily fully consciously, but my grandfather, my mother's father, was a priest and was a wise and kind and gentle man. And he passed away at age 96 in 2008, I think. And I didn't get around finishing the song until after he passed, which, like I said, I'm not sure that was a conscious thing, but it was probably a subconscious thing, because that's not a conversation I wish to have
over Sunday lunch.
My granddad,
yeah.
Anyway. Do you know what I mean? I mean, nevertheless, my mum's very religious, and it's a song that she finds troubling, shall we say. Not troubling, but she doesn't like it.
She's not overly happy with it.
Yeah.
I mean, she's coming to the show. Is it still in the set list?
Yeah, it has been here and there. I mean, beyond that, like, you know, the one thing that people have said, which I sort of take into serious consideration, is that if my aim at my shows is to inculcate an atmosphere of inclusion, which it is, that if you are a Christian who comes to the show, or indeed any other religion, that could be a sort of an alienating piece of music, and I get that, but
that's not where you're coming from, is it, lyrically?
No, it's not. I mean, this is the thing that I want that song to be, is it's my two cents. Do you know what I mean? I'm not saying that is the answer, but it's just, it's like, I've stood in enough fucking churches in my life, and when I go to church on Christmas Day, and when my friends get married, and if they have a religious ceremony, and I'll sing the hymns, because get over yourself, do you know what I mean? It's like, I'm not a fucking teenager anymore. I don't need to stand there going, oh, I don't believe this, not going to sing it.
Who doesn't love a good hymn along, sing along?
Right. Well, actually, a lot of the Methodist hymns of the 19th century are some of the most beautiful pieces of music and writing that I know, to be a pilgrim, whatever. These are wonderful pieces of music. But so I'll happily sing them. And I don't need to, like, cross my fingers while I do it or whatever. but it's a bit kind of like, I've done that, now it's my go. Which it actually kind of explicitly says in the lyrics to the song, you know. The other thing is that, you know, and this sort of plays into all of this, and I'm not sure if I do cover this in the book, there is human beings have what I would call the religious impulse, or perhaps more accurately, I would call it the communal impulse. It's a thing that humans want to do, is to be in a room full of people and become part of something bigger than themselves.
And that's music, right?
Yeah, well, it's an interesting psychological phenomenon, because I think arguably that same impulse, when ill-directed, gives rise to a lot of things like fascism. Do you know what I mean? I think that if you look at kind of footage of like Nazi rallies from the 1930s, that's what's going on there.
The hysteria.
They're subsuming themselves, something larger than themselves, to a terrible fucking end. And if we have that impulse, which we do, and there's nothing we can do about it, I'd much rather try and sort of direct it to less awful fucking racist ends. Do you know what I mean? And the fact of being in a room with a crowd full of people singing along with the song is part of that, and that's a good thing, you know. And I wish to sort of chase that in a way. AC Grayling the philosopher, wrote a book about atheism in which he had a sort of line about how, sort of acknowledging this communal impulse that humans have and saying, you know, maybe we need atheist gathering places and atheist, you know, singing churches and stuff. And I thought to myself, this man has never been to a good gig or football match for that matter.
Yeah, yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Because it's all the same impulse. And I think that it can be directed towards positive ends. So, and you know, having a room full of people singing along to Gloria Hallelujah might be one of those.
Well, it's all in the book, mate, from politics to religion to relationships to actual songwriting. What I wanted to ask you is, did you go about reading any other texts about this form of a book before going into writing, or did you literally just go, I'm going to just trawl through everything I've ever written, listen to it again, and then write this book?
Option two. And now you're actually making me feel bad, because maybe I should have done.
But no, I was just interested in the method.
At the same time, I'm not sure that I'm aware of any other books that are exactly like this in terms of format, and that's perhaps ignorance on my part, but certainly there's lots of kind of like... There's a thing I'm not very keen on when people publish lyrics as a poetry book. Lyrics and poetry are two separate disciplines, and there are very, very few lyricists whose lyrics survive on the written page without music. There are one or two, Leonard Cohen, John K. Samson, and Nick Cave, but for the most part, these are different things. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And it's slightly facile to pretend that they're the same. Sean Ryder just had a book of his lyrics published. I think he is a man with a great turn of phrase from here and there, but I do not wish to read Sean Ryder lyrics without the music. Thank you very much.
Twisting my melon, Frank.
Yeah. I think the thing was, it is in some ways slightly structurally similar to the first book, in that with the first book I read through my list of all my shows and picked out the ones that seemed interesting to me and then wrote each one of those up as a kind of mini essay. And I've sort of done the same thing with this book. I went through my catalogue and just thought which songs I had interesting things to say about and that weren't overlapping, and, you know, that I could write up at length, and then sat down. It was interesting. I mean, I did the research, whatever you want to call it, for the book was a case of listening through to every version, whether and you know, demos, sketches, live versions, whatever it might be that I can find, re-recordings, whatever, of each song. And that was actually a really fun experience for me. And certainly, the album Poetry of the Deed is an album that I've been a bit down on over the years.
You say that in the book, it's a problematic album in your canon, you call it.
I mean, the thing is, it is simply because we rushed it, which is entirely my fault. But having said that, like, I have reevaluated a bit in the light of writing the book, in the sense that I went back and listened to all the songs and went, oh, actually, you know, maybe it's not as terrible as I had it down in my head. It's also the 10-year anniversary this year, so we're playing it in full in Boston at Lost Evening, so we have to learn all the songs again, which is going to take for fucking ever. But it was definitely, that was the kind of methodology for it, was just kind of picking a song and going, what do I have to say about this?
What's the main things you've learned about yourself going down this deep Frank Turner rabbit hole? Because I imagine there is no better way to get to know yourself than now. Like, it's a journey of self-discovery, something like this.
There were interesting moments of me remembering kind of philosophical and methodological kind of like flags that I'd planted in the past that I'd sort of forgotten about. Do you know what I mean? And listening back to songs and demos and stuff, it was like, oh yeah, that's what I was kind of obsessed with back then. there were definitely some moments where I kind of thought to myself, not necessarily like this is repetitive necessarily, but like certainly moments of kind of going through it, and it's aided my writing going forward, in the sense that there are certainly bits where I was like, I have done that enough.
Yeah, tick.
Yeah, exactly. Don't have to do that anymore. That is covered. You know, move forward. I mean, the obvious example for that for me is that, like, in my later career, there was a moment where I'd become obsessed with simplicity as an idea, which was a thing of getting really into Bill Withers and Motown and this kind of thing.
Bill Withers, man.
One of the greats. But, you know, I definitely, with both Positive Songs and Be More Kind, had this obsession with trying to strip away and be simplistic and have just really simple, pure elements to songs. And I think I did that successfully. And now I'm kind of like, well, cool, fine. And I suspect that the next things I do will be more complex, because I feel that, like, I've done the simplicity thing for a while.
Yeah.
So
I love that, because, you know, certain artists, there's only a few that can churn out the same style of music and have people still dig it. AC/DC, Motorhead, Ramones.
Pennywise.
There's a few. But if you're not changing and mixing it up, then you're kind of stagnant as an artist, aren't
well,
you?
Well, yeah, completely. And I think it is a thing I mentioned in the book. There is an odd conservatism among music fans that I reject. I mean, I kind of understand the impulse, you know, if you like something, you want more.
I only like the early stuff.
Yeah, or whatever. Which is a legitimate opinion to have about an artist, but...
Who do you feel that way about?
Oh, Lord. Bob Dylan.
Bob Dylan. Really? Yeah. So you only like the sort of
I get off board with him after Highway 61.
Really? Blonde on blonde. You're not down into, with... Oh, man. Blonde on blonde.
Sorry.
Ooh,
Frank. Now I'm going to get hate mail
now. From me. It's good to switch things up.
Yeah, definitely. I think that artists have a duty to change. Do you know what I mean? I think that's... I don't wish to repeat myself. I don't need to write Love, Iron Song again. When I'm writing, there is a set list in my head. Do you know what I mean? I don't need to write a song that sounds exactly like Photosynthesis because that song exists. And if I wrote another one that was the same, then which one would go in the set? Do you know what I mean? It's like because I wouldn't want two identical songs in the set. And it's just about trying to go in other places. And even if you argue, which I would partially agree with, that my circle of... my stylistic circle is narrower than some. Nevertheless, within that, I wish to go to different places as much as I can. Do you know what I mean? I'm really excited. I have actually finished recording album 8. It's not mixed yet. But it certainly stylistically and musically and lyrically goes in some radically new directions. There's a full-on jazz song.
Right on.
Yeah.
Which
was a huge challenge for me to write because I don't really know and understand those chords. And I really sat down and learned a bunch of Thelonious Monk shit. And
because you wanted to, going back to this whole musicology idea, like you want to learn about the different lineages.
Absolutely. I mean, Thelonious Monk's a fucking genius.
Dip your toe in.
So learn from the greats. Do you
know what I mean? The shape of jazz to come, isn't it?
Yeah, right. Exactly.
No Him, No Refused. At least the title.
Yes. Well, it was an Ornette Coleman.
Oh, was it Ornette, was it?
Ornette Coleman did Shape of Jazz to Come and Refused to Shape of Punk. Maybe I could do a record called The Shape of Folk to Come.
There you go.
That would be bold. It's funny, like, both Ornette Coleman and Refused made an incredibly bold statement and then succeeded in living up to it, in my opinion. I'm not sure whether I'm capable of doing the same thing. But nevertheless, that might be a good idea.
Final song I want to touch on. You refer to it as perhaps the moment when you went too far into the pop world. I would like to bring you back because it's actually my favourite song of yours ever. The way I tend to be.
Right.
That song for me just hits me right in the sweet spot. I don't know whether it's the chords or the lyrics, but I remember the first time I heard it, I was like, this is a beautiful song.
Thank you. I don't wish to sound down on the song, and I hope I don't sound overly down on the song in the book, but it was certainly one that was a real challenge to get right for me. The early drafts of the arrangement of the song were overly saccharine. And when I was listening back to some of the rehearsal tapes I had, it was like, oh, man, fucking hell, it sounds like Jack Johnson. Do you know what I mean? And it was a real struggle to find how to pitch that song in a way that felt credible to me, should we say. But, I mean, I think at the same time, it was like I was kind of nervous in some ways about how direct it is lyrically. It doesn't really fuck around. Do you know what I mean? And it says something that's not particularly... hench.
Yeah.
you know what I mean? But it was, as I think it says in the book, one of my favorite things with that song was when we did the songbook thing a few years ago, Charlie Hugel, the engineer, the producer, I should say, I wanted to do a new version of the song, and Charlie and I discussed it at length and ended up trying to take it back to the first demo that I did of it. And he was like, it was obviously, you got as far as finishing it and demoing it, so something must have been exciting at that point. So what was that? Let's refine that. And we did. And like the version on Songbook is really special to me. So, but it's a funny thing because the other thing is like that is a song that is, in terms of my live sets and radio play, verging on overplayed. Do you know what I mean? Like, which is fine. I mean, it's lovely to have a song that people want to hear. That's great. No complaints about that. And I will play it. But it's just like, you know, it's... still in America, it's the song that gets played on the radio.
It's becoming the teenage kicks.
Yeah, a little bit. And you know, I'm grateful to have any songs that get played on the radio, so I'm not going to complain about it too hard. But it's just a little bit like when you show up at an American radio station and they're like, I'm like, what do you want me to play?
Hey, Frankie.
Yeah, and they're like, hey, do you want to play Where I Tend to Be? And I'm like, oh, yeah, that song from fucking 8 years ago that's two albums back. And like, fuck, man. But if they want to hear it, they want to hear it.
The curse of a good tune.
Yeah, I mean, I do think that artists being kind of shitty about having a popular song is a little bit...
It's like hating your own child, isn't it?
Yeah, it's just... Well, there's plenty of bands who wish they had any songs that were that popular. Exactly. So fucking, you know, take the compliment.
Well, final thing is the Flogging Molly Cruise. Mm. haven't confirmed it publicly, but I've confirmed it privately. I'm coming on board
Amazing.
As a DJ.
Okay.
And I know you're a man
fucking
who likes to don the Hawaiians.
Yeah.
So
are you going to wear a Hawaiian?
Always. That's my thing.
Excellent.
All summer
Get
long.
A silk one.
I've got one. I've got a couple. Yeah.
I discovered silk shirts.
They're beautiful, aren't they?
I'd never worn a silk shirt in my life, and I bought a secondhand one in a shop in Topanga Canyon in California, and was staggered by how great it feels to wear silk. And I know this now makes me sound like the least punk person in the universe.
I'm behind you, dude. I'm with you. Fuck them.
Yeah, it's like a thousand little angels caressing
it's
your chest.
It's so good.
It's lovely.
Have you done this cruise before?
I have, twice.
So tell me what to expect.
Drinking.
Yeah.
Shit, loads of drinking. It
sounds
it's
like my kind of party.
Kind of terrifying at times. On
it's
the
free
first,
booze on once you're on, it's like
yeah,
all inclusive, right?
It's endless. And it's fun, but like, fuck me. Like, it's an endless torrent of alcohol. But it's really fun. I think it's got better as it goes along, because I think we did the first year and everybody, artists and punters alike, were a little bit kind of like, what are we doing now? And I think that because there's a lot of repeat business on it, I think that people now kind of know the drill. And it's kind of fun, you know? I mean, everyone hangs out. And I personally end up playing 900,000 shows because I just get my guitar and wander around. And there's a wonderful show I did one year on the last night in a drained jacuzzi on the top floor of the ship.
Amazing.
With Will Varley. Me and him standing back to back singing, pissed out of our minds. At one point, Will actually fell over just straight like a fucking tree trunk, just went onto the ground. Didn't hurt himself because he was too pissed and kept playing.
Amazing.
And then there's a photo of me and him making out from that gig somewhere as well.
So expect the unexpected.
Yeah, but it's really fun.
It's a great bill this year as well. Pennywise are on there.
Yeah.
Stiff Little Fingers.
Yeah, it's
Bronx.
Amazing. Yeah, it's going to be a really, really fun trip. And you end up, one of the days you spend on a fucking private island. That's all right.
Good times.
Get behind that. But yeah, it's really fun and it's cool. There's a lot of kind of camaraderie, but there is a lot of alcohol. On the first year, so you sort of board the ship from about 10 a.m. and the ship leaves dock at 5 p.m. And on that first year, we got on about midday and I sort of put my stuff in my room and went down to the bar on the deck to have a beer and celebrate being on the ship. And this woman stood next to me, just threw up all over herself. And I was like, it's fucking midday on day one. Jesus Christ, slow down. The other thing that I remember from that, which was wonderful, was that, so there's quite a lot of bands who do these cruises now, and I was chatting with one of the stewards, and he said that the Foggy Molly cruise was the second booziest cruise that they do.
They've been beaten.
I said, who's the fucking booziest? Yeah. And John Prine ran a country cruise, and apparently the John Prine cruise drank the entire ship dry before they left dock on day one, and they had to delay casting off because they'd run out of
refuel.
Alcohol, and they had to restock the ship.
That's amazing.
Which is kind of terrifying in its way.
It's them big old country boys, isn't it? They can put it away.
Fucking hell, right. Yeah, don't drink with army people or country fans. Like, Christ.
Frank, I better let you go.
Man, it's always a pleasure.
Always a pleasure,
we'll
man.
We'll do it again.
And I'll see you probably at 2,000 Trees, if not before.
Which is going to be a blast. And we've got the
Mongol Horde coming back.
Yes, coming back for that, which will be fun. And we've got our headline set, and the bill is fucking incredible this year. Every Time I Die are doing Hot Damn in full. Hold on to your underwear. So it's going to be a really fun weekend.
Right on. Well, enjoy the rest of this book tour as well. And I'm going to come down and nick a copy if that's all right.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah?
Totally.
Love it. Cheers, dude.
Summer days I hide away and wait for rain to come, 'cause it turns out hell will not be found within the fires below, but in making do and muddling through when you know where else to go.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.